boiled down, what is womanhood?
Well, in the book, there's a line that Mildred says toward the end when she's in a pretty dark place, having kind of lost almost everything by the end of the book. She is confronted by a couple of women who don't seem to be accepting their situation as women, and she says to them that line, "This is womanhood boiled down," which I believe when Mildred says that, she's saying that this is women stripped of agency, they are stripped of their voices, they are abused, they are distrusted, and I believe she has come kind of full circle in the book to feeling like she's accepted that in a way. But I think her acceptance of it is also kind of the start of her new power that is coming out. And so for me, when she says that, it's almost, she's almost giving motherhood new breath.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Sharma Shields about her novel, The Cassandra. This interview contains content of an adult nature. Listener discretion is advised.
So your protagonist, Mildred Groves, also known as Millie and Mad Mildred, is a woman with visions, the novel's title referencing Cassandra, the woman in Greek mythology who could see the future, though no one believed her because she spoke in riddles. How did Mildred come to you, and what was it like to step into her reality?
Well, originally I was wanting to write a mad scientist novel a la Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and so I had been researching these different abandoned factories in Spokane for the setting. But at the time I had been, this was back in 2014, 2015, when my first novel was published, I had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And a couple of people, when I was speaking to them about the diagnosis, told me, oh, well, there are a lot of us that have multiple sclerosis in this area because we're downwind of Hanford. And that was the first time I started really thinking of Hanford seriously as a possible setting for the novel. It seemed kind of like the perfect place with its own dark secrets that I could explore. But I was really unversed regarding Hanford's history. So I booked a tour. It's now a national monument. Part of it is the B reactor there. So I booked a tour of that in August of 2015. And I went over and explored the B reactor, got to see the museum there, took a bus all the way around the Hanford Reach, which is enormous, and saw some of the communities like White Bluffs that were displaced there. And then I think it was really that tour that made me start thinking of Mildred and start thinking of this not as the Mary Shelley mad scientist novel, but as a historical novel set in 1944 and 1945. And what struck me as kind of the most surprising detail was that people that were working there, this enormous workforce that was brought in of 40,000 to 60,000 people, had no idea what they were making at Hanford and that it was going to be producing the plutonium, ultimately for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. So that struck me as so interesting and had so many parallels to our current era of complicity, of our militarism, and made me start thinking about some of the women that were going there for the first time to join the workforce. And Mildred Groves popped in my head, and along with it, the Cassandra myth.
Can you just describe Hanford for the listeners?
Yes. Well, Hanford was part of the Manhattan Project. It was selected by General Groves back when the Manhattan Project was first getting started. It was the very first nuclear reactor created anywhere in the world. the first successful nuclear reactor. They chose South Central Washington State and the Hanford Reach area because it's arid shrub steppe, it's extremely remote, it had really high winds, which they thought might help diffuse some of the pollution in the area. And then it also had the Columbia River, which is one of the biggest rivers in the continental United States. It's extremely powerful, and they needed all of that water to cool the reactors to create the reaction that they needed for plutonium production. And they liked that area because it also, the communities that they displaced there were smaller than some of the other locations they'd been looking at. And they basically gave people a month to move without any sort of payment for it or anything. They were just kind of kicked out, and they began construction and managed to build this thing in very short amount of time. So it's not too far from where I grew up in Spokane, which is in eastern Washington. It's just a couple hours drive from Spokane. And a lot of people call, you know, Spokane and other parts of the Inland Northwest downwind of Hanford because the wind can push some of that pollution. But I think what they found that they weren't expecting is how devastating the pollution was within the soil and how it harmed livestock. And then, of course, how it created thyroid cancers in people and birth defects and the like as time went by there.
As you just mentioned, the book takes place in central Washington, and you even cover some of the indigenous occupants of the area that were pushed out. And at one point in the book, you write a meditation from Millie. When I walked, I began to hear the very earth groan beneath my feet. What did it mean to be born white in this country, to speak a language germinated not here but overseas, to infest and control but to never belong or care for like a parasite? What horrors had we committed? What horrors did we continue to commit to the original inhabitants? How did you figure out that this was necessary, and how did you weave it in through her?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about my own complicity, my whiteness in an area that whites were the settlers here. We were not its original inhabitants. And in Spokane, where I grew up, we still have a very strong indigenous community there. And around Washington State, where my mom is from, Omak, Okanagan, which is where Mildred starts her life as well. And I wanted that to be very much a part of this book because I feel that our dominance and our violence against the original peoples here are very much connected to our militarism around the world. I believe it is very colonial in its roots, and this novel is really about staring our history into the face, all of it, even if it makes us feel uncomfortable and uncertain of ourselves and our identities. For me, that's kind of the only way that we can move forward and be a healthier country and be better in our local communities and all of it, if we can take some serious assessment of who we are and what we've done and how that's continued in so many ways today, how we continue to harm the indigenous communities today and how we continue to harm blacks in America. And for me, it's kind of all connected in a way. That misogyny, that racism, that globalism, that dominance, all of that, I think, is connected.
In the book, you attend to the land, the landscape, the flora and the fauna.
Yes.
you really create characters out of the land, the wind even. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to know about your history, what it meant to you to think about coyotes and herons. And
growing up in the Inland Northwest, I was a girl like Mildred who heard the calls of coyotes outside of my window and was so haunted by them because they really do sound like young women shrieking. And something about the terror and that noise and also how human-like it was has kind of stayed with me my whole life. I was a girl who played outside in my family's pasture. They had 11 acres, and I played out there on the scab land which was very similar, I think, to some of the areas near Hanford. And my mom grew up in central Washington, which is also very arid, just like Hanford, and has, you know, the sagebrush and that those smells of sagebrush and the really severe differences in temperature between the winter and the summer. And it just felt like it was always very intense there in a way that I wanted to capture in the book. And I also really wanted to pay homage to the creatures that are indigenous to that area, the heron, the type of mice that there are. The biggest predator there is the coyote. But I love that the heron is such a sinister predator, too. So she really became my focal point in the visions. You know, I have so much fun studying those animals and then putting them into the text and seeing them kind of breathe life into it and hopefully bring almost a sense of the mythological to it as well.
I can't wait to have you read a bit of a vision in a bit, but I want us to develop Mildred a little bit more for listeners. The Inlander calls Mildred a troubled and empowered protagonist. And one of the curious things is there a lot of female relationships for Mildred, you know, including the relationship with her mother and a woman she meets on the bus going to Hanford, Beth Green. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about Mildred in the context of these relationships.
Yeah, well, I really wanted the relationships between women to be at the core of this book. I will say first off about Mildred, I don't believe that she's an unreliable narrator. I think she really starts out this book not knowing herself entirely well and comes to know that self for better or for worse as the book moves along. And I think in the relationships she has with other women, they can be idealized, like with Bethesda Green, where she sees Beth as someone that she wants to be but will never be, in a way, kind of beautiful, composed, confident, you know, successful, great with men, comfortable around anyone, it seems. But Beth is going to have her own struggles, I think, that she's going to have to fight through in life. And with her mom, I think there is so much anger there between them both and frustration. She almost accepts that too much, that sort of cantankerous relationship they have. She almost laughs it off or ignores it until, you know, a moment strikes when her anger overtakes her, and then she actually grows violent with her mom, which is one of the earlier scenes in the book. And she alludes to it, to that scene from the very beginning. I think, you know, in a way, all of these women have very deep flaws in their character. They are all, maybe in that way, reflections of myself. I tend to be really hard on my characters because I think I'm very hard on myself as a person. But I wanted them to not be without redemption in some way. I wanted Mildred, most of all, to be both powerless and powerful, like we all are. We can all fight for a better world. We can all fight to do something better. And I think in some ways, she really fails at that in the book. And in other ways, she's more successful.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Sharma Shields about her novel, The Cassandra. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org. where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. There seems to be tension between obedience and rebellion.
Yes.
which feels both of the era and also timeless.
Yeah, yes. I've had a couple of reviewers tell me that even though they enjoyed the book, they found Mildred very frustrating. And I think she can be very frustrating in a lot of the same ways that I frustrate myself. She can be very eager to please, eager to be obedient to a fault. And I find myself doing that too, almost exhausting myself to please someone or please a group of people who I maybe don't even have much invested in personally. And I think Mildred suffers from the same character flaws I do in that regard. But one thing I really like about Mildred is that when it comes to like her visions, she actually is very empowered by them. At least at the start of the book, she really understands that this is something special about her that she has, and she doesn't necessarily feel embarrassed. She almost feels sorry for other people, you know, that they don't have this same strength that she has, or that they aren't aware of her own power, which she is aware of, I think, in a lot of ways. So, yeah, she's a interesting, hopefully multifaceted character in that regard.
I'm dying for you to just read us a scene from her vision.
Sure. I'll read from the chapter Skulls, which is after she gets hired at Hanford. She goes there to work as a secretary, and this is one of the very first visions she has while she is at Hanford. And like the mythical Cassandra, she has been having visions for some time, sometimes visions that she can't even quite make sense of. But this is her first vision concerning Hanford itself. I hunkered on a precipice overlooking the Columbia. The water coursed indifferently toward the ocean, gripped in its basin by the rocky fist of cliffs on the eastern side. The heron's black plumes stirred in the wind. I turned to her, waiting. Her beak remained closed, but she spoke to me as loud as a branch breaking. Watch the river. I watched. The water drained away, so slowly at first I wondered if I was imagining it, but then, yes, certainly, the water was leaving for good, as though the basin were no more than a long serpentine bathtub from which an invisible hand had pulled the plug. The shoulders of rocks appeared like dark scabs, thousands of them, and I fought the urge to run down the side of the basin and dance across them. The heron lifted her speckled throat and the long feathers on her neck jutted like thorns. Then she cowered and in a deft movement lifted away from the hill's summit, beating her large wings ponderously, swooping toward the desolate river basin. I beetled down the hillside after her, recalling how, when I was a girl, I would plunge down the bouldered embankment into the aching cold of the Okanagan River. On the rocky beach, the heron waited for me. She pointed her beak toward the belly of the riverbed. I ambled atop the black rocks, skipping from one to another, but they shifted beneath my feet. I slipped again and again, trying to gain purchase and failing. I wasn't annoyed. It was a game, no more, a fun game to play atop the rocks. And when I tripped into the small puddles of water, all that remained of the Columbia, I laughed and splashed. I put my hand against a round stone and was surprised to find it wet, not with water, but with something soft and fleshy. Algae, I assumed. Moss. I drew the substance away like it were the top of a mushroom, and it came off in my palm easily, with a little pop. The smell was both terrible and good, a burning, like over-roasted meat. I turned the thing over in my hand and stared for a moment, disbelieving, before dropping it at my feet. It was the skin of a child's face. The black stone was no stone but a skull, grinning at me fiendishly. I examined the other stones, the ones I'd danced across so clumsily and merrily, and they too were skulls, and beneath them, trapped in the mud of the riverbed, were the bodies. People of all ages, small children, others stooped and aged. A high-pitched whining started up in my left ear, the tinnitus I suffered during a vision or if I grew too exhausted. I found a woman with her breasts blackened and burned, pockets of flesh half-melted. Around her, some of the skulls' mouths screamed, others were pinned tight, addressing their end calmly as though struck dumb by its arrival. "Who are they?" I cried. "What's happened to them?" The wind whipped at me, scolding me, and some of the skulls crumbled into dust beneath her words. When I turned, there was the heron, picking awkwardly at the bones with her nightmarish toes. She lifted her head and gazed at me with the gold death coin of her eye. Eventually, we must become who we are.
You don't shy away from violence or even erotic taboo in the book, but I want to know about that last line, eventually we must become who we are. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the scene, the heron shifts from being a heron, looking, I think, slightly more innocuous, even though the heron is quite a predator herself. She shifts into a coyote because she is an Aufhawker, a German shapeshifter, as Mildred's grandmother would call her. In my mind, I was thinking about different types of predators. The coyote was, or still is, the most prolific of all the predators in the Hanford Reach. And I wanted that to kind of be coupled in a way with this predatorial nature that I think men have toward women, that countries can have toward other countries, this type of dominance and toxic masculinity that I think the book is really commenting on. And in my estimation, the heron is a bit of a trickster figure and is forcing Mildred to start looking at these issues more clearly. And so she has to work out for herself what exactly that means. Eventually, we must become who we are. And Mildred, as you know, if you've read the book, becomes a certain type of predator herself, a certain type of murderess in more than one way. And I think the heron is almost predicting this as it's unfolding.
There's a difference between Mildred's approach to violence and Bethesda Green's approach. And I want to read a bit of a reflection of a scene where Beth and Mildred are watching a fight take place at Hanford amongst the men. When there was a brawl, and there were many brawls, I found I couldn't tear myself away. I wanted to watch the men beat at one another until one of them surrendered or passed out. Beth was the opposite. She couldn't stand the violence. She said it was exactly what was wrong with the world. And what's fascinating about the book, again, in the dimension of characters, Beth abhors violence in sort of the global world, and then in her personal world is confronted by it. And I'm just wanting you to speak again to the complexity, especially as women. We often hold the paradox of shunning violence sort of outside of our home, but being confronted with it in a very personal way.
Right. Yeah. I will say about Mildred, I think she is a product of America in a certain way. Like, she is excited by violence and by masculinity, and she's very curious about it. And she is, you know, when these fights happen, she wants to kind of see, like, she wants to see the bones and the blood flying during them, which I think is a little bit how we can all be as complicit human beings who can be accepting of violence. But I think toward the novel's end, there is that shift where she does start to become more repulsed by that violence rather than attracted to it in that way. Maybe because her experiences with it become so personal and intimate. I really have felt writing this book and discussing this book after it was published that there is such a strong connection between how we behave on an interpersonal level with how we behave on a global level. And that I really want to examine that in myself, much the way that Mildred, I think, starts examining it in the book, too.
And you dedicate the book for Aitha Anderson, who loved me and warned me. Who is this woman?
So Aitha Anderson is my grandma, my mom's mom, who lived in Okanagan, Washington, was a woman who never learned how to drive a car, who also, just like Mildred's mother in the book, had a family that believed in end times and that they could come at any moment. And there's a scene in the book where Mildred's mother is preparing for a dance long before Mildred is born, and she's very excited for this dance and sews her own dress. And then the night of the dance, their minister comes and says, "The world is ending tonight. We're going to go onto this hillside and wait for the world to end, and we'll watch it burn, and then we will continue our lives." Mildred's mom in the book says, like my grandmother did, "Well, I'm going to this dance, so I'm not going to go sit on that hillside." And of course, her family forced her to. So she went in her good dress and her good shoes up to this hillside and sat there and really told me that she really wanted the world to burn while she was up there. She was almost hoping it would happen because she was so filled with anger. And so my grandmother was the storyteller, and she would tell me things like this. She told me a story about how her family never told her that she was going to have a period. So when she started bleeding, she thought she was going to die. And she went and was lying down next to a creek, just kind of waiting for darkness to fall and for her world to end. And then eventually, you know, roused herself and went home and told her mom what was happening. And I think because of her own experiences, she would warn me about things maybe long before I needed to hear about them. I think she wanted for the women in our family to be prepared and to not end up feeling trapped, which was frequently a way that she felt, I think. And I loved all of our conversations and all the stories she would tell me when I was a girl. And some of the stories she would tell me were very scary and alarming to me as a young girl, but I think in a lot of ways helped me want to become a storyteller myself.
This leads me to my last question, Sharma, which is, what's your message to the Cassandras of the next generation?
My message is to speak out against the voicelessness that I think the world is trying to put on us even now. When I was writing this book, I started it before the Me Too movement, before the Reckoning, before the Kavanaugh hearings, and it didn't even surprise me the ways in which this book ended up becoming as relevant and timely as I think it was to 1944 and 1945. We need to recognize that I think our violence toward one another, our violence toward women, and even our part as women in being complicit to the violence that we enact against one another in the world, both here in our country and abroad, all of those things are really connected for me. And I also feel like they're connected to Hanford, this place in Washington State that I wish more people were aware of. I hope people start educating themselves about that as well, because it's continuing to pollute the environment. Its tanks have been leaking. It's made the news in the New York Times and other locations around the nation for these issues it's been having with continuing pollution and endangerment of the employees there. So my hope is that we can just keep talking and listening, and that we can evolve as a people into something healthier and better.
Sharma Shields lives in eastern Washington with her husband and children. She's the author of the Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac, winner of the Washington State Book Award. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.